Good morning. Welcome. We are continuing our studies of Genesis. If you were here last week, you know that we left off just about verse 25 of Genesis chapter 30. We're not going to finish chapter 30. I'm trying to pick up the pace a bit here. So this seems a little hot. Is it a little too loud? Tweak it down just slightly there. We're going to pick up at chapter 31, and we'll cover all of that chapter. We'll be a congregational hour week, and pick up then. And if you're reading ahead, I know some of you are studying ahead, so we'll be looking at chapters 32 and 33 both the following week. That'll be the 14th of March. Then we're going to move fairly rapidly over the next probably five chapters or so. We may cover all of that in about one Sunday, just a kind of quick warp speed sort of leap up to the part of Genesis that takes up the story of Joseph. And I'll try to summarize what we're skipping over, but again, my interest is to try to wrap up our studies of Genesis this year. And to do that, we'll have to make a little bit of kind of a sprint through that midsection there. So anyway, I'll give you a little fair warning of that when the time comes. But at this point, we are, as I say, at chapter 31. What's happened, if you recall from our discussion last week, Jacob has been now 14 years in the enterprises of Laban, his uncle. He's been serving the first 7 years for what he thought was Rachel, but turned out to be Leah. And then Laban was able to negotiate with him, so to speak, an additional 14 years in which Jacob would then labor for Rachel as well. He didn't have to wait the additional 14 years. It seems pretty clear that he married both of these sisters more or less at the same time. But then the agreement was that he would continue to serve the next 14 years. At the end of that time, the text tells us that Jacob approached Laban about heading for home. And it seems that Jacob at that point was ready to go, that he had had enough really of work in this household. But at the same time, we also have an impression that he had received some sort of vision from God, which indicated to him that, and this is a little bit oblique in the text, and so I'm giving you what I think is the best opinion of how do we construe it, is that if Jacob stayed, that God would provide an inordinate number of sheep and goats that would be born in an unusual sort of visible fashion. That is, they would be mottled or ring-staked or striped or speckled, you know, that sort of thing, a kind of variegated coloring. And the idea when in the hands of Jacob. Now, the text is the last part of chapter 30. It may or may not be abundantly clear that that's what's going on, but commentators themselves puzzle over it just a bit. But that seems to be the idea. So the long and short of it is when Jacob approached Laban and said, "I'd like to go home," Laban proposed that Jacob stay around for a while. Jacob obviously had noticed how well things have been going with Jacob there. He surmised that this was nothing other than the blessing of God, kind of slopping over to the broader enterprises of Laban. And so Laban did not want to see Jacob leave and said to Jacob, "Well, name your wages. You've earned now the two sisters, but I'd like you to stay, so what will your wages be?" And Jacob, based on that vision, proposed that he would be compensated by these sheep and goats that were born in this unusual coloration. So that was the deal that they struck. And then, as you can probably guess, virtually all the sheep that were born in that, you know, colored variation. And it was very unusual. And so all of a sudden, Jacob began to just become incredibly wealthy by virtue of the multiplication of these sheep and goats. And along the way, Laban noticed that things weren't quite going as he had anticipated, and so he actually changed Jacob's wages 10 times, redefining which sheep would accrue to Jacob's ledger, you know, as it were, as opposed to Laban's. But every time he changed the wages, God in his providence changed the manner of the birth of these animals. So over the 6 years, Laban became increasingly unhappy. and somewhat frustrated with things, and Jacob noticed that. And so we have 6 years of a kind of gradual separation of these two men in their opinions of each other. And by the time we pick up the story now at the end of the 6 years, we can tell that there's some true hostility that has developed between them. And that's really it. If you've ever read this chapter 30 and puzzled over the little section there that talks about Jacob taking some branches and peeling off the bark, are you familiar with that? You know, sometimes we read that and we think, what is that? And, you know, again, commentators themselves wonder about that. It seems that what's going on is that Jacob was relying on a common understanding, not true, but common at the time, that whatever these animals were viewing at the moment they were engaged in reproductive activity, get my drift, whatever they were gazing at that moment would have some impact on the type of offspring that they would bear. And so Jacob was, you know, trying to sort of stack the deck somewhat in his favor by putting in front of these sheep these striped logs. Now, just in case you're wondering, it really doesn't have any effect, you know. There is no connection there whatsoever. But Jacob thought there was. And the text doesn't tell us directly that that actually had anything to do with the way these sheep were born. But it does tell us something, that Jacob is still in the business of playing games. He's just still a little bit of a trickster. Not the way he used to be, but there's still a little bit of that in him. And so that's the best we can make of that. If you've ever wondered about it, as I have, that seems to be the right view of it. All right, so let's pick up then. Again, we'll take this text a paragraph at a time, rather than reading the whole thing at once. It's a quite lengthy chapter, and we'll just hopefully be able to get through in the time that we have here. So let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll get underway. Our Father, we are grateful that you give us this privilege of continuing our studies of the Old Testament, and particularly now this unfolding story of the life of Jacob and the adventures that came into his life. We pray that we would learn as well the lessons that you have for us, and that as a result of these times of review, that you would instruct us in the ways that we should trust you. We give you thanks for it now in Christ's name. Amen. All right, picking up, this is page 27. If you're using the Pew Bible, we're at verse 1, chapter 31. Now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, "Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and he's gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father." And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him as favorably as he did before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your ancestors and to your kindred, and I will be with you." So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was, and said to them, "I see that your father does not regard me as favorably as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I've served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not permit him to harm me. If he said, 'The speckled shall be your wages,' then the flock bore speckled. If he said, 'The striped shall be your wages,' then the flock bore striped. Thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me." So we have this powwow now that Jacob has with his two wives. Notice all of the factors that play into Jacob's decision to make this rather dramatic move back home. He's been here 20 years. And what is it that leads a person to make a radical change in their lives? This, at least I think, gives us some suggestions along those lines. I mean, you know, of us in this room, some of us have made big changes in our lives, career changes, that sort of thing. How do we know that God is in such a huge change of direction? Notice all the things that play into Jacob's life. For one thing, he wanted to go home. For the last several years, he had wanted to go home. 6 years earlier, he'd actually voiced that interest. So there was an inner disposition toward going this new direction. God doesn't typically call us in a direction in which our own inner disposition finds itself utterly hostile and antagonistic. Sometimes we are called to do things that aren't very desirable, but generally God goes with the grain of our desires, and so it's at least one of the ways in which we can have some sense that God may be moving us in a certain direction. But then coupled with that is the fact that now Laban and his family are becoming hostile. This is what lawyers call a hostile work environment. You know, no longer does he feel this warm acceptance by Laban and his family. Jacob's feeling like the odd man out. He's no longer invited to the parties, you know, and all of those things are militating in his own imagination to suggest that he's no longer welcome here. And that, again, can be just a sort of a providential circumstance that God may use to suggest to you that there may be a different direction to go. But, of course, above all of those comes this word from God himself. God said to Jacob then, "Return to your land," as if to confirm what was already brewing. Now, God doesn't typically, I don't know about you, he doesn't ordinarily speak to me vocally. I don't hear voices. And yet somehow there is a sense in which God can actually impress upon us sometimes what his direction is. And so that again becomes some sense of possibly a new direction. But then Jacob goes beyond that and calls his two wives, who are sisters, who, by the way, have not been noted in recent years as agreeing with each other on much of anything. And he pulls them out and has a little powwow with the two of them to now get their response, telling them this story, telling them how he's perceived Jacob's change of heart toward him, how God has been blessing him nevertheless, as if to get from them some idea whether they are going to support him in this decision. All of these things taken together represent a kind of reasonable approach to a big decision, and so all of it, I think, gives us some instruction as to how we might similarly approach such a circumstance. Here, Jacob tells these two sisters the story. The father has cheated him. He's changed the wages, all of these things. And yet God has, notwithstanding all of that, continued to bless him. So what are they going to say? Jacob continues to speak now, beginning at verse 10. And this is part of this interesting little story we were mentioning earlier. "During the mating of the flock, I once had a dream in which I looked up and saw that the male goats that leaped upon the flock," the Hebrew is quite difficult there, and that's about the best we can make of a translation, "the male goats that leaped upon the flock were striped, speckled, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Look up and see that all the goats that leap on the flock are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I've seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now, leave this land at once and return to the land of your birth.'" So Jacob is continuing now to describe to Rachel and Leah kind of the history of his experience, and he refers back apparently to a vision that he had early on, 6 years earlier, in which, as I was saying, he had this view, as it were, of a kind of strange relationship of the mottled sheep to the offspring of the herd and flock and that sort of thing. And again, it's obscure at best. That's all I can say about it. I've done a little bit of reading, in fact, quite a bit of reading this week, and I still come up saying it's pretty obscure. But there's some idea that Jacob had this vision that led him to the conviction that we've been describing. And it seems to have been what disposed Jacob then to propose to Laban that his wages be constituted by these mottled, speckled, and spotted sheep and goats and so on. But at the same time, we have another reminder that's given to Jacob here that the God who is speaking to him is the God who he encountered back at Bethel, the place where he had the vision of the ladder. That seems to be the last great moment of worship in Jacob's life. Of course, we don't know the whole story. 20 years, you know, is capsulized here in about two chapters, so obviously there's a whole lot we don't know. But there is at least a casual impression from reading these chapters that Jacob, while he is a changed man, as it were, after Bethel, is still not a great man of faith. In fact, some of you asked the question last week, one person in the question period and a couple more afterwards. It seemed as if Jacob, in this whole story about Rachel and Leah, was very passive. You know, what's with Jacob here? He just sort of goes doting along, doing whatever he's called to do without any particular personality to speak of. And you almost feel like, what's wrong with this guy? That he keeps just accommodating himself to these odd requests and so on. And that is the impression you get of Jacob. It's still not Jacob at his best. It's not the Jacob who was the duplicitous, deceiving, conniving character of an earlier time. Bethel changed him, but he's still not quite there yet, and now he's just in an almost passive state. And we don't get a sense of a man of great faith, a man of great courage, a man of great obedience, but more that he's just, as I say, passive. If that's the case, and obviously that's quite speculative, then it may be this reminder, I am the God that you worshipped back there at Bethel. Remember me? I'm the one who's been blessing you all these years. I'm the one who's been watching out for you and protecting you. And here Jacob now repeating this and pointing this out to his two wives, Rachel and Leah. All right, so the response from the two wives then at verse 14. Then Rachel and Leah answered him, "Is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he's been using up the money given to us. All the property that God has taken away from our fathers belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said, do it." So he gets confirmation from his wives. As we indicated last week, typically this bride price that was paid in the ancient Near East would accrue to some degree to the benefit of the wife herself. It wasn't understood as just being paid like a price tag to the family, but it was supposed to be something that would, in a sense, establish the wife herself in this new marriage. And yet Laban is not playing by those rules. He's been pocketing, as it were, all of Jacob's labor, taking it to himself. None of it is going to the benefit of Rachel or of Leah. He's been treating them almost as though they were slave girls, less than his own daughters, treating them as if they were commodities, you see, and they're feeling that, and they're resenting that a little bit. Where is the benefit that's supposed to flow to us from all of Jacob's labors? 14 years he's been putting out, giving and giving and giving, and yet what do we have to show for it? You see, is really the spirit of their response there, and at least in terms of the custom of the day, that was a legitimate grievance on their part. And so that has also disposed them to be less than attached to Laban. God using all of these providential factors, as it were, to set things up so that this really dramatic change will take place, in which now after 20 years, Jacob is going to gather up his family and go back to Canaan. So whatever God has told you to do, let's do it. So that's what Jacob needs. Now, there's something here that Jacob should have done, and there's something that he actually did. And I think we'll detect what it is as we go along. Verse 17, "So Jacob arose and set his children and his wives on camels, and he drove away all his livestock, all the property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Padan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan." Now, a little hint here, we don't quite catch it in the English translation, but the in verse 17 where it says, "Jacob arose," the Hebrew word there is actually a word that means to pant, as if to be out of breath. And the sense of it, therefore, is that what Jacob did, he did hastily. That's the derivative sense. Jacob did something more or less quickly, and the impression is slyly, you see. So we still have a little bit of deceit, as it were, a little trickery going on in Jacob's strategies here. He's moving too fast. There's something less than dignified about exactly the way he approaches this. So Jacob arose quickly, as it were. He gathers his children. He gathers his wives, put them on camels, drove away the livestock. All of this happening virtually under the cover of darkness, you see, very quickly. He wants to kind of escape That's the picture that we get. All of this that he had acquired paid an Aram, and he heads off to return to his home in the land of Canaan. This is not what Jacob should have done. This is not the way to do things like this, to just sneak out in the middle of the night. What Jacob should have done was gone to Laban. He should have, been up front. He should have said, "Look, Laban, we got a problem here. I want to go home. You apparently don't want me to. We need to work this out." He should have been transparent. He should have been up front. You see, Matthew 18, that principle, if you have a problem with a brother, you go to that person. You don't go to a third party or go off, sneaking around in the shadows. There's a kind of upfront transparency about the life of faith and the life of integrity. And Jacob doesn't quite hit that mark, He sort of falls below that standard, and he's doing stuff hastily. There is a lack of haste, really, in the life of faith, a kind of dignity and propriety about it that speaks of a sort of depth and character that seems to be lacking somewhat here. If we doubted that, the next little paragraph gives us plenty of reason to believe that's what was going on. Verse 19. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. Starting out, he crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. The texture of this paragraph really doesn't leave us much question about what's going on. Laban was 3 days away. He had gone to shear his sheep, and his flocks were separated by some distance from Jacob and his flocks. And so Jacob is using this as his opportunity to make his escape. Rather than waiting till Laban returns and trusting God to protect him, rather he wants to just sneak out in the dark of night, as it were. And so Laban is away shearing his sheep. That's sort of the time of harvest. It's a time, to some degree, of being of some festivity. And Jacob, for whatever reason, was not invited. Jacob is separated from Laban at this point by a considerable distance. And so Jacob is preparing this rapid escape, now Rachel does an odd thing. She steals her father's teraphim is the word, the household gods. Jacob is the leader, and whatever standard of ethics you establish as the leader, in your company, in your family, in your club, in whatever it is, if you're the leader, it's very rare for those who are under your leadership to establish a higher standard than you yourself set. There is a tendency for us all to emulate the one who is in that position, and that's why people in leadership need to set a very high standard. Here, Jacob doesn't set such a high standard. Everybody watching him knows that he's sort of moving now with deceit. Actually lapses to the point of pilfering from her. Reasons we'll talk about in a minute. But just notice how that occurs. If the president behaves poorly, it tends to affect how the culture behaves. When the leader behaves poorly, it tends to affect, and by the way, I intend zero political comment by that. I'm just saying, as a matter of fact, isn't it true that we are always affected by those who are in those leadership roles? And it's just an important, something for all of us to bear in mind, especially when we're in visible roles of what kind of standard we set. And Jacob here now seems to influence his whole family to a lower ethic. All right, so Rachel steals the household gods. What in the world is that about? There's an interesting one. These teraphim were little figurines, probably about a foot tall. They reflect the customary Oriental veneration of ancestors. You know that in the Orient, that's very common to venerate and even worship in some cases ancestors. And this is the Near East. It's very close to the Orient, and some of that influence is certainly present there. And that's what these teraphim were, these household gods. They were little images, human-shaped, usually made of wood. that were designed to represent fairly used worship. Although they actually used these teraphim for something like what we would call kind of reading the future, sort of like tea leaves, you know, or a crystal ball or something like that, where you're trying to surmise what does the future hold, and you'll go and by various incantations using these household gods be able to read the future. That was the common use of them. And obviously from a Christian point of view, and even from a biblical point of view, we would doubt the efficacy of such a device, but nevertheless, it was commonly used. Rachel stole those household gods. Why would she do that? Boy. Now, this is interesting, and again, commentators have a variety of views of this. I think the most appealing explanation is that Rachel herself was a little concerned about Laban and how he was going to respond to this escape. And she was trying, as it were, to blind him so that he couldn't divine their route of departure, you see. These household gods were used for that sort of thing, to try to see, as it were, by mystical means, things that would not be ordinarily visible. And she thought possibly by stealing these gods, she was putting the blinders on Laban so they could have a better chance of escape. That's probably the favorite explanation among commentators. Other explanations are that Rachel herself wanted to have the means of, as it were, reading the future, to have that device at her own disposal. Some have suggested that Rachel was stealing these because they may have been covered with gold. They were wooden figures, but they would sometimes be gold-plated. And they might have had some value, and maybe she was trying a little self-help compensation for what she thought she had been deprived of because of her father's being so greedy. At least, that would be a possibility. And there's actually some other explanations that become somewhat more bizarre. But those, I think, at least to make the most sense, and of them, I prefer the first of them, that I think Rachel here, partly out of her resentment for her father anyway, and partly out of fear, steals these. She's not sophisticated theologically, as far as we can tell, and so she probably believes that they could be used for that purpose, and hence she puts them away, and away they go. Jacob obviously doesn't know about this, as the ensuing story makes clear. All right, so from there, verse 22, on the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. So he took his kinsfolk with him and pursued him for 7 days until he caught up with him in the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, "Take heed that you do not say a word to Jacob, either good or bad." So Laban, we have the picture here, not happy, gathering his kinsfolk, setting out in hot pursuit. It took 7 days. Jacob had 3 days head start, but he's traveling quite slowly. He's got children, he has flocks, he can't move very rapidly. Laban is traveling quite rapidly, but it took 3 days for him to get the word, and then he sets out on the, 3 days coming back and another day or two till finally he catches up with Jacob on the seventh day. The impression here is that Laban intended to do Jacob harm, however that might take place. Not clear what he had in mind, but he was angry, and this was some kind of resentful, vengeful energy that was now motivating Laban. That's the clear impression. But God intervenes. You see, God can do that. God could have done that anyway. That's why Jacob didn't have to be so stealthy about this. He didn't have to be so secretive. He could have been up front, because God protects people as they do the right thing. That's the business God is in, is protecting us as we do the right thing, even though it seems risky at the time. And so the lesson we should learn here is we don't have to engage in this skullduggery beneath the surface, watching out for ourselves, hedging our bets and all of that, because God is there to guard the righteous. And Jacob should have been righteous. God's guarding him anyway, in spite of his lack of virtue here. But so much more God would have guarded him had he done the right thing. So God confronts Aramean. Laban warns him at this point not to speak a word to Jacob, either good or bad. The Hebrew suggests from good to bad, meaning Laban might have shown up and said to Jacob kind words at the beginning, but immediately run the conversation in a more evil, threatening, harmful direction. But he's not permitted to go from good to bad. It seems to be the subtle sense of the Hebrew text there. So, next day, verse 25, Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsfolk camped in the hill country of Gilead. So Laban comes, and here's the first speech. This whole, the rest of this chapter is a colloquy, really, between Jacob and Laban, and Laban gives the opening parley. Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done? You deceived me and carried away my daughters like captives of the sword. Why then did you flee secretly and deceive me and not tell me? I would have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre." Right, you bet, you know. But why did you permit me to not kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? I mean, this guy is really, you know, piling it on, and we can have our own assessment of the sincerity of all of that. "What you have done is foolish. It is in my power to do you harm," which strongly suggests that was his intent at this point. "But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Take heed that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. Even though you had to go because you longed greatly for your father's house, you poor homesick pup, why did you have to steal my gods?'" You see, bottom line, there's the gotcha in this. You know, after all of this kind of fluff, there is one legitimate gripe that Laban can lay on the table, and it would be highly embarrassing to Jacob that would be the case. Now, obviously, Jacob knows nothing of the stolen household gods, and so his response is a little bit precipitous and not very cautious, as it indeed should have been. Jacob, again, what should he have done? He should have said, "Well, that's interesting, Laban, especially the part about the household gods. To be honest with you, I don't know anything about that. Let me make some inquiries." You know, that's what Jacob should have done. Jacob didn't know what the others of his household might have done, but he becomes a little bit too righteously indignant. "Because I was afraid." Now, that's the truth. "Because I was afraid that you take on me." That's why Jacob left secretly. He was afraid he was going to be deprived of everything that he had earned, and God would have protected him, you see, but at this point his fear overwhelmed his faith, and so he left secretly. But now, verse 32, "But anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsfolk, point out what I have that's yours and take it." Now, Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen the gods, you know, obviously, or he would have been a little bit less dramatic in making such a pronouncement. But essentially what he's doing is giving Laban now permission to check out the camp. "Okay, Laban, see if you can find your household gods. Go right ahead, and it's open season." So Laban went into Jacob's tent, then into Leah's tent, and then into the tent of the two maids. Notice he saves Rachel for the end. She was probably his favorite as well as Jacob's favorite. She's the baby in the family, you know. She gets kind of special treatment. And so he goes to everybody first, keeps Rachel to the end. Then he entered Rachel's. Now, Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about in the tent but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Oh, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me." What does that mean? So he searched but did not find the household gods. All right, isn't this an interesting scene? Laban now finally enters the tent of Rachel. And Rachel is sitting on the saddle. Now, these saddles were a good-sized piece of equipment. They would put them on the camel, and they would sit on these as they traveled. Then they take at night the saddle off the camel and use it as furniture, because they were that big. So Rachel is here sitting on this good-sized saddle, which is doubling as a kind of little chair there in her tent. And Laban goes in and, you know, probably does some little benign perfunctory greeting to Rachel, and then he rummages around and, of course, doesn't find the household gods, and yet conspicuous, referring, of course, to our monthly. It was a view idea, but it was shared well, that a unness about her and should not be touched by a man. Now, we view that as a little odd, but then we're viewing it from, 3,000 years down the road, and obviously at the time, there was different perspectives on things, and that was just sort of a given. Ordinarily, what Rachel would have done was stand in deference to the presence of her father, and then he would have greeted her by embracing her or kissing her or some customary greeting of the Near East, but because she was at that time of the month, she would not be touched, and so she would not rise, and hence she gives this response to her father, pardon me for not rising, but this is the reason why, and Laban doesn't push that point. I think it doesn't cross his mind, it doesn't even seem to him fathomable, that those household gods could be in that saddle where Rachel is sitting now, you see. That's what it, and there, the commentators point out the subtle and ironic humor of this. This is God poking fun at household gods. That's what's really going on here in a subtle kind of behind-the-scenes way, is that that's what God makes of household gods. This is the height of an insult to any household gods you may have in your life, you see. That's what God assesses them to be worth. Put them in a saddle and sit on them. That's exactly what the deal is. And any ancient Near Easter reading this would have just chuckled like mad that here's Rachel sitting on these at this moment, you see, in her monthly. I mean, it's just the insult to them is unspeakable. I don't want to go into it more deeply, but that's the idea. So there's a lot of kind of subtlety in this whole deal. Well, Laban doesn't push the point. And so he walks outside, then outside the tent, and Jacob now, feeling fully vindicated, just comes uncorked. I mean, he gives a speech that I bet he'd been practicing for a good 5 years, over and over, and so here it comes. There, it'll take very little comment. It really does speak for itself, but let's just listen to it. So Jacob, this is verse 36, became angry and upbraided Laban. Jacob said to Laban, okay, so what's my offense? What's my sin that you've so hotly pursued me? Although you felt about all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsfolk and your kinsfolk so that we may decide between us two. These 20 years I've been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, and I've not eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn by wild beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. Of my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. It was like this with me. By day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, and 6 years for your flock, and you've changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. Okay. Round one, Jacob. Boy. So I think Jacob had been going to sleep at night, waiting for an opportunity to get that off his chest. And he had the opportunity to do so. So anyway, I think it speaks for itself. Let's go on from there. Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters. The children are my children. The flocks are my flocks. And all that you see is mine." Now, Laban probably doesn't mean what it sounds like he means. He's not actually saying here that all of this is in fact his. But what he means is the seeds of all of this is his. The flock that Jacob has now began with Laban's flock. The family began with Laban's daughters. All of this was rooted in that which had been originally Laban's, you see. And that's true, and that's legitimate, and that's probably at least something to be said. But he then goes on and says, "But what can I do today about these daughters of mine, or about their children whom they've borne?" See, Laban has been had. This, even though he's tried his level best to take advantage of Jacob, and even though Jacob has not been as virtuous as he surely should have been and could have been, nevertheless, God has been there guarding him all along, and Laban is stuck. And that's it. And so Laban, all he can do is put a sort of a defensive proposal into the conversation. Come now, let us make a covenant. Literally, it's let us cut a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. This is a defensive thing. This is like establishing a demilitarized zone, putting a UN observer force out there, a sentry who is going to guard these two men from any further attempts to harm either one the other. That's really the sense of it. This is not they kissed and made up. This is two enemies in a covenant-cutting ceremony establishing a truce and demarcating that truce by means of an altar, a covenant, a pillar, a memorial, and so on. And that was customary, and that's indeed what they did. So let us make a covenant. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. This is the second now pillar in Jacob's life. We talked about Abraham was a man of altars, Isaac was a man of wells, and Jacob is a man of pillars, memorial monuments. And this is the second of them now. So Jacob set up this stone pillar, and Jacob said to his kinfolks, gather stones. And so they gathered stones and made them into a heap. The heap here presumably was to become an altar upon which a sacrificial offering would be made and then eaten by the two parties. And that was a sacramental way of saying that they had reached a truce and they were solemnizing it by means of this ceremonial meal together. And so they took these stones, they gathered them up, they made the heap, and they ate there by the heap. Laban called it Jagar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galead. Both of those terms mean a heap of witness or a pile that is going to stand as a memorial witness, a memorial reminder of this moment. Laban said, verse 48, this heap is a witness between you and me today. Therefore he called it Galead, and the pillar Mizpah, which is watch post, if you look down in the margin there. Again, the same idea, a kind of a sentry, as it were, out there, a silent sentry guarding the boundary between these two men. For he said, the Lord watch between you and me, when we are absent one from another, if you ill-treat my daughters, or if you take wives in addition to my daughters, though no one else is with us, remember that God is witness between you and me. So this is Laban's terms that he sets out then in this treaty that they established between the two of them. Verse 51, then Laban said to Jacob, see this heap and see the pillar which I've set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and I will not pass beyond this heap, and you will not pass beyond this to me for harm. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. You'll recall that Abraham and Nahor were brothers. Jacob is a descendant of Abraham. Laban is a descendant of Nahor. He's appealing back to the point where these two men, brothers, worship the same God and appealing to that God to then sanctify this relationship that's solemnized in this treaty. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and Jacob offered a sacrifice on the height and called his kinsfolk to eat bread. And they ate bread and tarried all night in the hill country. So we have here one of two great moments now that are going to come in rapid succession for Jacob. One, he reaches peace with Laban. Then he'll reach peace with Esau. The next time we're together, we're going to see that. Our next occasion of studying together 2 weeks from now, we'll be looking at Jacob wrestling with the angel. A fascinating story in the encounter at Peniel, followed the next day by his meeting with Esau. You know, if a man honors God, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. There's a principle there. And even Jacob, who is not really honoring God like he should have, He's falling beneath the standard. Even there, God is still making his enemies to be at peace with him. It's a remarkable aspect of the life of faith that God can take even those intractable enemies and put them in a position of peace. And, the task we have is simply to trust God in that regard and allow him to do so. Just one little note here. This phrase, the fear of Isaac. You'll notice that we have a reference to the God of Jacob and the fear of Isaac. And commentators, again, are somewhat intrigued by that. I think the best take on it is that Isaac himself had drifted some, as we saw when we were looking at his life, and that he was rattled back into a recognition of God by that incident where he was said to have trembled violently when he was undone. He had been trying to sidestep God's direction, but God had trapped him in it and determined to do what God had intended all along. And that seems to have been a shattering moment for Isaac. And it seems that that was the last imprint in Jacob's mind concerning Isaac and his relationship to the deity, the fear of God. It's a good thing to fear God. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. But in Isaac's case, it seems to have been the conspicuously apparent aspect of his view of God, was the fear of God. He'd been, as it were, exposed by him, caught by him. And so that may be the reason that we have this ongoing impression, such that Jacob would speak of the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac. That's speculative, but it may be the case. All right, very quickly, then we'll be done. So early in the morning, Laban rose up, kissed his grandchildren and his daughters, and blessed them. Then he departed and returned home. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. Probably the same angels that he saw on that ladder, you see, so many years ago, now meeting him, as it were, once again. Okay, well, thank you. You're very kind. Let's have a word of prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Our Father, we're grateful that you are a God of providence and grace, and that indeed, even as we see in Jacob's life, that he could behave less than admirably, and yet you nevertheless protected him. We've seen so many times that you've done the same thing with each of us. When we have fallen short of the mark and really not trusted you and let fear overwhelm our faith, even then, you watch over and you provide and you protect. We pray that we would learn the lessons that we ought to from this great story, and that we would know that we can with great courage do the right thing, and that you are the God who watches over us and protects us and cares for us each step of the way. We give you thanks. We ask your blessing on the service to follow, and all of these we offer in the name of Christ. Amen.